Tēnā koutou, welcome to season 5 of the New Zealand Society of Authors Oral History Podcast. I'm Karen Hay. The writers this season have spent decades in the pursuit of creativity and the art of writing, encountering resistance and criticism, personal tragedies, praise and success. It's going to be a great season. I'm glad you can join us. This year, the 50th anniversary edition of the novel Tangi has been re-released. It was the first novel by a Māori author ever to be published. A short story collection from a few years earlier, Ponamu Ponamu, had been the first fiction book of any kind by a Māori writer. These books had the same author, Witi Ihemaira. There have been many books, much success, some scandal, and full and vibrant careers in diplomacy, teaching, theatre, opera, film and television for Witi over the last half century. And there's no way we can cover it all in the podcast, but we are going to cover some of it, starting with Witi Ihemaira talking to Deborah Shepherd about the writing scene he launched into at the start of the 1970s.
The literary high ground in those days was taken by a certain kind of person, And that person would have been the editor of Landfall. Mm-hmm. That person would have been Alan Curnow in poetry. Mm-hmm. That person would have been C.K. Stead. That person would have been Bill Pearson. Mm-hmm. And all of these people knew Al, and they knew Patricia, but they didn't know me. So I was the sort of cuckoo in the nest. No. I came up so fast, I think.
Yes.
You know, I really came up so fast, and then there I was, and I wasn't really what the Māori department at Auckland University was expecting. They were expecting someone who was, well, because they were the ones, one of the ones that David said he got a letter from, because I was writing these stories, unsophisticated is mainly the main criticism. That these stories should never have been published because they're unsophisticated and they don't show Māori within their, you know, they're just about a little boy and growing up in a small whānau.
But that's their value, isn't it? That they are about a little boy growing up in his whānau, and it's coming, it's the truth. What's the word that you, a tika? And it's real experience.
Mm.
And early experience that it's lost to us now. People, nobody lives in that way anymore.
No.
With a grandmother saying karakia to the eels. And so,
well, that was New Zealand as it was. And I think that, I think with all due respect to them, I think it would have been great if they'd got the kind of author that they wanted. But I wasn't that author. And I had waited for that author. They were waiting for 4 or 5 years at least. I thought, well, you know, if there's nobody else coming up, then I'm going to do it. And so the reason for that embargo was for exactly the same reason. I thought, I'm not the only fish in the sea, so let's wait and let's see about who comes out of it. But again, it was just me, Patricia, and then of course Kerry,
yes,
and then. Who else was there?
Mm.
Oh, Abirana Taylor and Bruce Stewart. They were the main ones. Oh, and one more. Bub Bridger.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So it was good, but it wasn't good enough. And so I couldn't wait any longer. So then I decided to come back. By that stage, that had also given me a chance to grow, because I've always felt that my job is to be a witness for my times. And so
that's it.
I had been a witness for my grandmother's times, for my times, and now I felt that it was time for me to witness what was happening in the political sense rather than just in the aesthetic sense.
And the criticism was that when at the time that you were writing, that wasn't the reality of most Māori in New Zealand, that they were living in urban realities, harsh realities. But still, you were documenting an earlier time. In the writing.
I was of the 1940s
and 1950s. So that needs to be taken into account. That period when you stopped was then you were very busy being a diplomat and doing the non-fiction projects. Mm. And I like the way that comes in at that point. And, well, once again, you're okay. doing a job, aren't you, of ensuring, of yeah. finding the writers.
Well, I've never felt that writing is just writing.
Mm-hmm.
That that creating the opportunities for others is also a way of writing. So I got a phone call from Hone Tuwhare, and so this is in answer to
writer.
What are the things that I've done for PEN. Well, I have never had any time to do anything for PEN because I've been trying to do things for the Māori
yeah.
Fraternity and for the Pacific fraternity.
Yeah.
And so as far as the Māori fraternity was concerned, I had a phone call from Hone Tuwhare, who said that he was put, and I had never met Hone at this point, but he'd heard that I was living in Wellington and he knew what I was good at, which is organising things. So he said, oh, I've heard that you can help us to get the money out of Creative New Zealand so that we can send some buses up to Te Kaha. And so would you be able to make an application on behalf of us? We're going to call ourselves the Māori Writers and Artists Society. So I said, sure. So I did this application and sent it in to, it wasn't called Creative New Zealand at the time, it was called the QE2 Arts Council.
Yes.
No, it wasn't even the QE2 Arts mm-hmm. Council, it was the Arts Council. And so that put me on their radar as a Māori to go to person. So I put this application in for three buses, one bus to come up from Dunedin and pick up people on the way up, and another bus to start in Wellington to go on to Te Kaha, and a third one to come down from Auckland. But then they wanted outcomes, so they just wouldn't give me the money without my saying what was going to happen.
Mm-hmm.
So then I had to construct these outcomes. Now, the interesting thing about that is that that taught me about how to apply for things and what people wanted and how to make an application that would go through.
Mm-hmm.
There were a number of people in the Arts Council at the time who were really wanting this to happen. So it's not as if it was against the grain of what they wanted to happen. Well, on the bus, there was about six people from the Arts Council actually came along because they wanted to see what was going to happen. And then on the basis of that, I was called by the Minister of Internal Affairs, and the Minister of Internal Affairs said, we do not have any applications, not applications, but any representations from Māori to the forthcoming QE2 Arts Council bill.
Mm-hmm.
And we wonder whether or not you would like to put a submission in.
Right.
So I put the submission in. I put it under the name of the Māori Writers and Artists Society. In that submission, I said that what was needed was a Māori council, a separate Māori council,
mm-hmm.
and that we needed to have programs to assist with marae development. We needed programs that would assist with traditional as well as contemporary arts and culture. And on the basis of that that submission, I asked friends of mine, and they were Tamati and Tilly Reedy, to come along with me, and Tui Zanatich and two others from the Māori Writers and Artists Society. And so they did. And on the basis of that, although they didn't decide to establish a Māori Arts Council, they did ask me to go on to the inaugural QE2 Arts Council as a member. So I went on that council, and through that council met people who then helped me to create what then became the MASPAC, Māori and South Pacific Arts Council. I had not wanted to have a South Pacific Arts Council. I had only wanted to have a Māori Arts Council.
Right.
I said at the time, it would be better if there was a separate
yes.
South Pacific
mm-hmm.
Arts Council. But Hamish Keith, who was the then director, argued against that and said, well, you know, really, we can't create another one. I can remember vividly the day that we were sitting there. Arthur Hilton, Nicholas Tarling, Derek Firth, and they were all talking about the need for more money to go to the South Island, that we needed to find equity in QE2 Arts Council funding. Mm-hmm. And then I said, well, you know, Māori need funding too, and it seems to me that we need to also establish a fund for Māori purposes. Then Hamish said, we haven't got any money left, we've dispersed it. And I cried. I just burst into tears. I honestly just cried. Cried. And in the end, it was Derek Firth who said, well, let's have a look at that budget again and maybe we can find something. And, oh, so here's $10,000. Why don't we give some money towards this new council? So we started off with $10,000. Hasn't been easy. It wasn't easy because then when we did do this, and then the news got out that there would be this new arts council, then one of my dearest, dearest, dearest friends, then he was the chairman. He was the chairman of the Māori performers kapahaka group for all the whole of New Zealand, Kingi Ihaka. And he met the Minister of Internal Affairs in the street and he said, oh, I hear that there's a new council being started up. I should be the head of that council, you know. And so when this was reported to me, I laughed and I said, well, yes, he's right, he should be. But then again, he shouldn't be because we need somebody who's more involved in contemporary arts. But anyway, so that was the first thing. Next thing was Michael Volkeling and I were rung up from the Māori Council and Graham Latimer. And we were told in no uncertain terms, the Māori Council requires you to come to attend their meeting on such and such a day to explain what this new council is going to do. So Michael and I went down there and we walked into the room. And honestly, you know, Pat Hoheper was there, he was my old lecturer, and all of these people, and they were really steaming because, for this reason, A, I had put up a submission to the bill, which they never knew about, and B, they were the ones who were supposed to look after the welfare of the Māori people. So when I said, well, look, I'm sorry, but you weren't looking after the welfare of Māori people, otherwise you would have put your own submission in, but you didn't. Mine was the only one to go through. Their secretary, a man by the name of Watene, yelled at me, that's a bloody lie. And I said, I can only tell you what the minister's office told me. And he told me that mine was the only submission. And then Pat stood up and he said, this new initiative has all the hallmarks of disaster. And he has never, ever apologised ever since that time. And this was in 1971. So those years were fantastic years. I wasn't writing, but what I was doing was creating the opportunity for
others,
all writers, all artists, and not just contemporary. Another huge battle in the second Māori Writers and Artists Conference was the contemporary art practitioners were saying, well, we don't want to come to a marae because every time we come to a marae, we always get hassled because our art is not traditional. And when we come here, clearly what then happens is that the marae will take over. For instance, in the second one, all of the artists put all of their work on the wall of this whare. And then at the end of the conference, when they went to take them down, the elder said, oh, you can't take them down. They're up on the wall now. They have to stay there, you know. So there was a lot of learning that was happening during those years about how to negotiate the Māori world and how to negotiate the Pākehā world. And I was in the middle of that, and so I could see where things were going. So partway through that whole process, those 10 years, another interesting thing happened, and that was that the Arts Council then decided that they didn't want to have a Māori Arts Council. So I had to go into bat and say, well, if you mustn't get rid of it until you have established constituent bodies for Māori art practice, Māori literature, Māori music, in the same way that you have a symphony orchestra, an art gallery, or whatever. And so they took that on board, and out of that then came Toi Māori Aotearoa.
Mm.
And then from Toi Māori Aotearoa, it came down to me and Pat. And this is one of the things I think that Māori do, which Pākehā don't do. We have to get in their boots and all.
Mm.
So as well as writing, we had to take lessons in how to write, you know, like
submissions.
To teach people how to write, because there was this huge upswelling of, well, you know, we want to write, we want to make movies, we want to do this, we want to do that. And so she and I were always taking workshops.
Yes.
So I couldn't possibly work for PEN because I was already too busy going from marae to marae doing these courses. And so, and she was too. We were all trying to help to get to grow.
Pat who?
Patricia Grace.
Oh, Patricia Grace, yes.
We were all trying to grow the whole field.
And you were also doing that through publications, into the World of Light and the Te Ao Marama, weren't you?
Yes.
And even growing up Māori in there, so creating opportunities.
The constituent Māori body that looks after Māori writers is called the Te Ha Committee.
Yes.
Well, when the Te Ha Committee was first set up, again there was a lot of controversy because Te Ha means the breath.
Yes.
And so just as there had been controversy over the fact that Mira Tamita had called her movie Māori, mm-hmm. with Māori as a very sacred concept,
right.
There was a similar controversy over the use of Te Ha. And so I just let this conversation go, and I heard all of these things because I'm a reasonable person and I like to listen to what others have said. And then Tungia Baker was the one. She actually got up and she said to this meeting, there must have been about 80 people there, she said, well, actually, you've got it all wrong, because this committee is not named after the breath. It's named after Witty's father. And when she said that, you could have heard a pin drop, and then there was, oh, well, if it's named after Witty's father, that's all right then. So it has not yes. It has not been easy, and it has continued not to be easy. About 20 years later, I was on the Heart of the Nation committee, and this was a committee which was to look at arts and cultural development in the next 50 years. So I was on it with Sid Mead. I asked for Sid to come onto it. Hamish was the chair of that committee. It was established under the Labour government, mm. and I think it's still a fantastic report,
mm.
which gives New Zealand the opportunity to track a bicultural practice in culture. So that was one, and then the final one was the New Zealand Book Awards, where the Book Awards now has an award that's given to a book written in the reo. And that came about because I was on the committee in the year that a book was put up to the for the award, and it was in Māori language. And the only person who could actually read it with any competency was me, even though my reo was not very good. The other judges had no competence to read it.
Mm-hmm.
So my argument was, if two of the judges are not competent to read this book, then we cannot simply exclude that book on the basis that of our ignorance.
Yeah, that's right.
So therefore, this means that we must set up a special award for a book written in the reo. And the two others who were on that committee at the time were Ralston and also Lindsay Dawson. Mm-hmm. And they both agreed, and we put that up, and I'm really very, very proud, mm-hmm. you know, that we now are able to give an award to a book written in Māori.
Mm-hmm. Just while we're on that topic, how many of your books have been published in Te Reo? Punamu, Punamu?
There's Punamu, Punamu, there's The Whale Rider, just those two.
When were they done?
Punamu, Punamu, around about 1978.
Oh, that long ago?
Yes. And
that was incredible for the time.
Wild Rider, about 1981.
Both early. So What created the receptivity to doing that at that time with a publisher?
David Heap was a wonderful man, and he had a colleague, Morris Douthwaite, and so they were trying to replicate from out of Heinemann Educational the similar framework that Heinemann had made for the Heinemann African Educational Series.
Mm-hmm.
And so they thought that they'd give it a try with one book at least in Māori, which was Pōnāmu. It's really interesting to, you know, to see how New Zealand's publishing practice hasn't only just come out of what New Zealand publishers have said should happen, but also from the internationals who have felt that maybe what will work in Africa will also work here.
Yeah.
And I suspect that that's probably one of the reasons why Pōnāmu was of interest to them, because it seemed to fit within their own particular model. Black writing from Africa, now black writing from New Zealand.
Yes.
And one could also extrapolate that to Pacific writing, because a man by the name of Uli Beyer created black writing from Papua New Guinea. And so that there's that entire generation of writers who came out of Papua New Guinea at the time in Fiji from the University of Suva, who've been influenced by that same transnational international movement.
Yes.
I'm Karen Hay, and this is the New Zealand Society of Authors Oral History Podcast. We'll be back to the podcast in a moment, but we want to remind you that the NZSA is the professional representative body which lobbies for the rights of all authors in New Zealand. NZSA will be representing writers in the ongoing reviews of the 2019 Copyright Act and campaigning for a stronger public lending right. NZSA collaborates across the sector to raise the visibility and discoverability of local books and local writers. To learn more about these important issues and to find out how to become a member, visit authors.org.nz. After 30 years of writing, Witi Ihamara's career took another turn with the release of the film Whale Rider in 2002. The film is based on his book, The Whale Rider, which had been published 15 years earlier. Witi told Deborah Shepherd how the release of the film changed him.
There's no doubt that had not the film Whale Rider been such an international success, then the book would not have been an international success. And it's always a huge pleasure for me to see when the book is named in librarians' lists as being After Heidi, or, you know, or one of the top children's books in the world, or in Russia, or in Japan, or in France, and that the film is still regarded as one of the top films for young children, especially young women.
Wow.
So that makes me really proud.
So it's the most translated of all your books?
Yes. What happened for me when Whale Rider happened was that it turned to me and my thoughts towards becoming an Indigenous author, embracing that more than being just a Māori author. And so from 2002 onwards, I've assumed more and more of that mantle of speaking for Indigenous peoples and Indigenous literature.
I had also the question of the impact of academia on your writing, which I wanted to know about.
Okay. So both the Indigenous and the academic thing has been really interesting. I now teach every year at the Banff Centre in Canada in their Indigenous Arts program. I have also taught at Washington University in Washington, D.C., teaching Indigenous literature and Black literature and creative literature there. I've taught as the chair of the University of Hawaii, their citizens chair, teaching creative writing and Indigenous literature and Polynesian literature there. I've taught similar courses in Taiwan now and also in Noumea. I think that the value that I give is mainly not in the work, but in being able to try to create new possibilities for Indigenous young men and women who may grow up to be artists or may wish to take up the arts or literature as their careers. It conforms to Māori thought, and that is that, you know, you become a mentor, you become a teacher, and you pass things on. And I always am a person who likes to pass things on and make sure that what skills I have I can pass on to others. Douglas Cardinal once said, and I was present at the time, and I thought it was a most wonderful thing. He said, when you start thinking about something or an idea or a project like a book or, in his case, a work of architecture, it already starts to exist in the future. And ever since he said that, I've always viewed that as the most wonderful ideal for anybody. So that therefore, if I start talking to young men and women now, then they begin to exist and their work begins to exist in the future. So it's a way of creating a psychic connection between themselves and the work, so that they will complete it. So now that seems to be my, you know, the theme by which I now live by my life, and that is that whatever I do now, it will begin to exist in the future. And if I can put everything, all of my work into the future, that's where it will continue to do its best work.
Yes, it will. I'm also thinking about this great work you've done as an anthologizer, because, I mean, it's when a person is published that they are a writer, isn't it? And you've done that for so many Māori writers.
Those books were really difficult because there weren't that many published writers in the 1980s, because Don Long and I brought out Into the World of Light, and that was a collection of people from 1970 through to 1984, and that followed on from contemporary Māori writing by Margaret Orbell, because she had made the collection in 1970. So Into the World of Light was a 14-year window from 1970 to 1984, and then when Don approached me to do Te Ao Marama, I then thought, this is an opportunity we can't refuse. And so I went to my publisher, Ian Watt, and said to him, you know, Ian, we've got the chance here to recreate within from 1985 through to the year 2000, a 15-year window on what was happening in New Zealand Māori culture.
Yes.
And it's a project that I have not seen any other country do at all, and we have the chance to do that. So will you allow me to do 6 books? And he said, well, can you do it in 2? And I said, no, I think we need 6. But if we publish one first and then the next one, well, then they will build readership and audiences, which is what happened. That was a relief, because what that meant was that Don and I didn't have to apply a strict and exclusive methodology in selection. What it meant was that we could go into places where you wouldn't normally go, which is into small newspapers and magazines, and find the work. So I think that overall around about 60% of the work in the 5 volumes that we put out had never been published or anthologized before. So the important thing is that it allowed people and all their work to be published that otherwise would have disappeared from the planet, basically.
Yes.
The 6th book was supposed to be done by my cousin Hardy Williams, and Hardy was at the time working in Radio New Zealand, so it was supposed to be an oral version. And what it was that he was to record people so that instead of reading the work, you would hear it. Because I think part of the success of my work is that I'm always reading it aloud to myself, because in Māori, mm. the Māori literary tradition, it's just not read. It's you know, you hear it. So my idea was that Hale would go and record some of these people reading and singing their work. Unfortunately, he then left Radio New Zealand. Mm. So that the fifth volume remained undone. Then I tried to negotiate it to be done by Apirana Taylor, who was then working for Learning Media. But then that fell over because there wasn't enough support for it. So it's still an unfinished collection.
Still might happen.
But I did do two others, yes. or three others. One was Where's Wadi?
Yes.
And then another was Growing Up Māori.
Yes.
And then the last one was Get on the Waka.
With your editors, how much do they edit your work?
Good question. So, because I write so fast, my first draft is usually ratchet. I always think it's 70%. Sorry, 60% right. When the editor comes on board, the second draft is around about 80%. So I really listen to the editor, because then they're the ones who tell me how to make my spontaneous draft into something that is more artistic and more shaped and more sculptured and more like an echo chamber. I've always said I don't really look for perfection, that if it's within, say, 90-95%, okay, I'll pass it.
Hmm.
And the reason is that I have in my brain an idea that there's something that isn't right in the work is your personality. And if I don't watch out, all of that will be perfected away. Mm-hmm. And so that roughness,
yes,
that ability just to go a little bit further in with the wet or all of these things I preserve in the lack of perfection.
Who sustains, supports, inspires you in your writing now?
I'm just so self-directed that I don't have anybody to support me.
Although I guess what you said about the publishers before is there's a sense of that them supporting you through this.
Mm. Yeah. Okay, so I suppose in the end, okay, so I belong to PEN and I belong to Māori organisations and I belong to theatrical organisations. I'm a member of the New Zealand Writers Guild. And so those are all really important to me in terms of the industry and in terms of being a professional in the industry.
Hmm.
Without them, then I wouldn't have the possibility of becoming part of a writer's community. And so because of all of those, then I'm able to keep myself in touch with what's happening and also keep involved physically by attending various meetings with what the business is. I was one of the trustees for the
Michael King,
and I've been a member of the New Zealand Film Commission. I was on the board until a year ago.
Mm-hmm.
So all of those are part of the whole function of being a writer. And so I guess my answer to your question is that they support me and I support them.
Mm.
Yeah, mm. New Zealand Book Council, they support me and I support them.
That's
that it's a reciprocal relationship. I've never really thought of myself as being, the passive recipient of their largesse. It's always something that I give back. I have personal opinions about, as I've mentioned, about the ways in which the Michael King Centre is going. I do think that they need to get back into really focusing on history, because that's what Michael wanted.
Yes.
And that's what that centre was supposed to be.
Yes.
I can understand why, it went the way it was, and I think that a lot of people have benefited from the short-term fellowships and short-term courses.
But now you think
it's
time
to nurture and we do need to develop New Zealand historians of quality and New Zealand historians who are telling the big story. I think New Zealand still needs big stories. And so my function is to continue to tell the big story.
Just about writing in the circadian rhythm, and I was wondering how long it takes you to recover from a project and then begin again. And
recover? I'm constantly rewriting all of those projects, so I don't actually recover. I just renew them, and I find a huge sense of joy in renewing them.
That's been another big part, hasn't it, of your writing, that you have gone back to a number of the books and rewritten them.
Yes, I rewrote Ponamu Ponamu because although it was aesthetically pleasing, it wasn't politically pleasing to me. I rewrote Whānau because although it had text, that is, it told a story, it didn't have the historical or social context that it should have had. I rewrote Tangi because it was actually only part one of a two-part book, always. So I was able to rewrite the second part of it and then join them both together as The Rope of Man. I've rewritten The Matriarch. It now exists as another version, which is 200 pages longer than the first version. And I call it my Matriarch Redux version. Yes. I have rewritten, in very small ways, The Wild Rider around about seven times. I am in the process of rewriting The Trawena Sea, not because I want to hide anything, but because I do think that it is probably around about 100 pages too long. I think I gained a lot of this from my understanding of in Māoridom, you know, we would create a Māori meeting house and then we would recreate it. So it's that whole cyclical nature of our own art practice.
Yes, and carvers would go back and recarve, or
Recarve, yes. Like there are around about three versions of Poho Ōrauiri, which they now call Poho Ōrauiri 1, Poho Ōrauiri 2, and Poho Ōrauiri 3. And then one of my mother's meeting houses, Rua Tepupuke, there's about three versions of that. One of those versions is in the Field Museum at Chicago. So that's been a huge inspiration, you know, to me, to know that I can do it. I know that there were some practitioners who were really fascinated by that fact, and I have always said to them that I've never ever thought of my work as being static. It's always evolving.
And organic.
Organic, yes.
You've been listening to an interview from November 2015 between Witi Ihimaira and Deborah Shepherd on the New Zealand Society of Authors Oral History Podcast. There's so much more to hear from Witi, so we'll be joining him and Deborah again for our next episode. We hope you'll join us then. You can find episodes from past seasons and be notified when the next episode is available by subscribing to the podcast on SoundCloud or wherever you listen. This podcast was produced by Elizabeth Kirkby-McLeod for the New Zealand Society of Authors, with audio support from Yana Tanahu Owen. Notturno by Ottorino Respigi, which you're listening to now, is performed by Justin Bird. I'm Karen Hay, and this was a New Zealand Society of Authors Oral History Podcast. Ka kite anō, oia koutou.